When hinges creak in eldritch chambers, and strange and terrifying sounds echo through the halls, whenever candlelights flicker where the air is deathly still, that is the time when we call to the dark spirits with ghoulish delight. Welcome, foolish mortals. As the moon climbs high o'er the dead oak tree, we summon the great spirit of one who brings to mind images of murderers and madmen, premature burials, and mysterious women who return from the dead. Edgar Allan Poe. See the feeble gleams of light try to make their way through the deepest corners of this mausoleum. Now breathe in this delicious atmosphere of sorrow. You feel the deep and irredeemable gloom that hangs over and pervades all. Or is it your imagination? See how the walls have been lined with human remains, piled to the vault overhead as in the great catacombs of Paris.
Don't step on the remains.
Let me out! Let me out of here!
That one sounds like he's still got some life in him. It's time. Gather around as we summon the spirit of Edgar Allan Poe to join us.
Cerebrus curator silenti, sino phasmatis venire contra mihi, phasmatis radix quod causa vita, commodo adeo suffragium mihi in meos negotiam. Our honored guest has arrived.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, spirits of the dead who stood and lied about me are again in death around me. My parents were actors whose purpose it was to please. Then I claim my birthright this evening as the heir to their talents and to their purpose to entertain the wise and prove worthy of your patronage. You are here this evening, no doubt, to hear yours truly recite the most popular poem ever written upon these shores.
Welcome to the first of a trilogy of episodes featuring actors and writers discussing Edgar Allan Poe. Today we are talking with actor Elizabeth Shepherd. I was especially excited to discuss her dual role as Rowena and Ligeia in Roger Corman's iconic film, The Tomb of Ligeia, opposite the legendary Vincent Price. She recently recorded a CD reading of the original Poe story that the film was based on, and when she's not performing, she teaches at Stella Adler. And now, here's the lovely and talented Elizabeth Shepherd.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you with you about Tomb of Ligeia. It's my favorite of the Corman Poe cycle. And I think it's really interesting now that you just did a CD of the reading of the story. So
yes. It's
a nice sort of, yeah. So do you want to, you take it. Tell me, you know, what you want about the film and then about the CD.
Well, I'm glad that it was your favorite of the Poe series. And, you know, it was Roger Corman's favorite, too.
Yes.
And Vincent, I think all of us kind of were very conscious we were making a very classy film. And Roger, because it was the last one, made an extra effort with it. We had for Roger an epic schedule. I mean, we were 5 whole weeks where
wow.
You know, he would make a film in 5 days. And he was already filming in England, and we had 1 whole week of location in the beautiful English countryside, and that was the first in the Poe films, you know, to have such a to open up the whole telling of the story, you know, with location work. And apparently, Vincent and Roger had always wanted to do one of these films with a real ruin. And so Roger Corman went around all the heritage sites in England and picked this beautiful, the Castle Acre Priory, which, you know, stands in for the Abbey, so that all the external shots are the real location, the Castle Acre Priory, which is an amazing ruin, as you can see from the film. And as soon as he pushes open the door to take me inside, then we're in the studio. So he wanted to make this last one, make it special. And so he got Robert Towne to write a script that was more in depth emotionally than the other Poe films that he had made. As a matter of fact, the film deviates quite a bit from the original story. When I knew I was going to be doing it, the first thing I did was read Ligeia, the Poe story, where Ligeia is this amazing woman that the writer is obsessed with. And as you see in our movie, Ligeia is this rather ominous presence in the background. And I was rather indignant on her behalf to begin with when I read the film script. But Roger Corman explained to me, he said, well, you know, Elizabeth, an opium dream isn't really very cinematic. So he and Robert Towne came up with this wonderful alternative of mesmerism, which indeed was very, very popular at that time. Mesmer was well known, you know, and so it is indeed quite feasible that somebody like Ligeia would have latched on to this, and then it is her way of keeping connection with Verdon after her death. So I completely bought it, but I thought it was a wonderful substitution. And then, of course, you know, it gave me the opportunity to, in my two roles, to turn from one character to the other during the mesmerism scene, which was exciting.
Yeah, I was, you know, I'd forgotten until I was doing a little research lately, and I'd forgotten you played both roles.
Yes.
So
yes.
How was that for you? Was it fun? Was it challenging? Was it?
It was quite challenging, but great fun. I'm putting it on speakerphone.
Okay.
So that I think I can you still hear me?
Yeah, you sound fine.
Yes. It was rather thrilling, actually. And, of course, I mean, the two women had a certain amount in common because they were both strong characters. In creating the character of Ligeia, as much of it as you saw, I was very much guided by how she was described in the original story, and particularly the quality of her voice, her very low and compelling voice. And, of course, the character of Rowena, who is really just a cipher in the original story, was created, really, by Robert Towne very well, I may say. She's a very sparky character. So I had to learn to ride side saddle. I'm not a horsewoman at all. that was fun. And as a matter of fact, the way a side saddle is designed so that for your right leg, there's a hook on the saddle where you can, which you can clamp your leg around. And on the left-hand side, your left foot is in the stirrup. And then there's a hook going the other way, which you can brace the left knee, so that I felt tremendously safe, I must say. And And so I had a wonderful Dorothy, who was the horse wrangler and also my double when you see both of the ladies together, both of the women together in a scene. She was instructing me with the horse riding. And, you know, on a film, there are very often, if you have an animal, there are several looking exactly the same. So there was a one horse that was used in the hunt and for the jumping, and another very sprightly horse that she was going to use to ride into set. And then a really boring horse that I was supposed to sit on, you know, to do. I looked at this boring horse and I thought, oh, Rowena wouldn't be seen dead on this horse. So I said, give me the sprightly one. So in the end, I did all of my riding except for where Rowena jumps over the wall, the little wall. Dorothy did that. And when the horse throws me, Dorothy reared the horse. There's one shot that I can see that's her. and then I fall off the horse. But that was exciting to add a new skill, although I really haven't followed up in real life. I haven't become a horsewoman, but it's interesting the things that you have to learn sometimes,
a role. It's amazing. Yeah, I think that's exciting to be able to add, you know, a new skill and not be afraid to, you know, push yourself or challenge yourself.
Well, the thing is that when you're in character, you know, when you embrace a character, once I became Rowena, then, I mean, she knew how to ride a horse, and so I did, too. You know, you kind of take on the character. So it wasn't Elizabeth riding that horse. It was Rowena, who loved doing it. So I was in character. And quite proud of myself that I was able to do that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, I've acted, but I'm always basically playing myself. So it's not, you know, I don't really play other characters.
Yes. So you know, nowadays, because there's so much typecasting, this kind of versatility where you immerse yourself in a character is perhaps not considered so commercial, you know, because then people don't know who you've come as. You know, many stars really do play their personality, particularly nowadays, you know, but the great screen acting, you know, has a versatility, and as far as, you know, the art of acting is the ability to truly imagine what it feels like to be somebody else.
I think it's an amazing skill. I mean, you know, watching someone become someone else, it's really fascinating.
Well, I think that it's a gift in that, you know, like my mother played the piano and her hands were just at home on the piano keys. She just knew what to do. That was her gift. I did not have that gift. I had to learn, you know, how to play, and I had to learn a piece of music. You know, I was not at home on the keys. But if I open a script, the words come off the page for me. That was my gift. And I think that sort of spontaneity, which is really the kind of spontaneity that children have, where you can immediately, your imagination immediately puts yourself inside another situation. I think that is something that an actor is gifted with. To be able to do that. They're just able to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like any, you know, talent, and then you hone
it. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, some people can play all sorts of games brilliantly. You know, other people just can always win at cards, you know, or whatever. You know, I mean, there are many different gifts that people have.
And I
so
think
honoring
them is the trick, right?
Yes, and I think that then, indeed, as I say to my students, because I teach Shakespeare at the Stella Adler Studio, that when you have been gifted with this ability to enter somebody else's life, you must honor it. It's been given to you for a reason. That then, you know, becomes your calling to use that gift in a creative way.
Do you have I know you've done a bunch of Shakespeare. Do you have a favorite piece or character?
Well, yes. I mean, many Shakespeare characters. You start off as Juliet, you know, and I played her several times, and Juliet and all the young ones, and then, you know, you go on to Lady Macbeth, and Portia is another wonderful, and Helena in All's Well That Ends Well was a very, very favorite role of mine. But of the older characters, a role that I loved playing was in Henry VIII, Queen Catherine of Aragon, who fights for her marriage. And the words in the scene where she is pleading with the king not to to throw her aside were the words that Catherine of Aragon herself used. Shakespeare has taken them as the basis. And so it's so eloquent. And I always felt as if I was part of history. You know, when I was waiting in the wings to go on, I felt as she must have felt as she was waiting to go into the court to plead with her whole heart for everything that had mattered in her life, you know? And the fact that the generosity of this woman's heart, in the very last scene when she is dying, she is really concerned about Henry's soul, that this decision, which goes against everything that they have believed, you know, in the church and everything, her love for him is still undiminished. And that strength of heart and character really appealed to me very, very much. It was a wonderfully strong role. So, you know, there's the span of Shakespeare is a treasure for me. But another role that I really, really loved was Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire, where, again, you know, that when the more I read about Tennessee Williams and his own relation with his sister, who had some mental problems, but what he talked about was her gallantry, her bravery and fighting for her own sanity, you know. So I took that as my understanding of Blanche. There was another role which was really sort of important historically in my mother's courage. George Tabori, a Hungarian writer, wrote about his mother's own real experiences during the war. In 1943, the Jewish population in Budapest had been left alone until then, but now they were starting to be rounded up. And so his mother, on the way to play cards with her sister, was picked up and put in the train to go to Auschwitz. And halfway there, at the Polish border, they were taken off the train to wait for the Polish train that would take them to the camp. And there was a friend of the family who said, "Oh, Mrs. Tabori, this must be a mistake. You shouldn't be here. Go and tell them. Go and tell them." And so she walks across the corridor, the courtyard, I beg your pardon. She walks across, fearing that she would be shot at any minute. And she talks to the young German officer there and makes up some story that she had, she'd left her pass, you know, and this was all a mistake. And the fact was that he took pity on her. He showed her mercy and released her. And in fact, in the play, My Mother's Courage, she takes the train journey back with him. And he talks to him about to her about his own experience. And years later, she says this amazing thing to her son, the playwright who is writing this story. She says, "Darling, you must never look into the eyes of the enemy. Otherwise, you might stop hating him and so betray the dead." Which was an amazing statement. So speaking for the Hungarian Jewish community, I felt was an enormous responsibility, particularly since I am neither Hungarian nor am I a Jewish woman. But I felt as if I was speaking for a whole community in a very important way. So that was rather thrilling to do.
It sounds like, I mean, you for building your characters, you really do the research, like whether it's historical or literary.
Yes. And that's fun, you know. I mean, that's wonderful. it's rather, it's absorbing, totally absorbing to do all that research. And, you know, any actor who is taking their work seriously will do that. I'm certainly not alone. I'm one of many who, you know, who really, really dig the foundation for a character, particularly when you have to sustain the character over a run. And we did that play several times in different places. So, you know, you need to be on a firm foundation in order to keep it alive.
Yeah, and I imagine it just creates, you know, I mean, having the respect for the character, too, you know, makes it, you know, an honor to portray it.
Absolutely. And without judgment, you know, I mean, I admired her very much, and I sympathized with Blanche, you know, and other characters. But if you are playing a character, a character who does things of which you personally would disapprove, it's really important to take that judgment out of your work on the character. You have to find out why they behave as they do and what makes them a human being who does behave like this in order that you will be true to them and real for the character. I remember reading when Bruno Ganz had to play Hitler, a man whom he hated and despised. He had to really strip his mind of those political opinions and really find out what his life had been from the beginning. In order to be able then to get inside him.
Yeah, give him any kind of humanity without just being a caricature.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I must say that when I played Mrs. Thatcher in a TV show in Canada called Shades of Black, I mean, I can't stand Mrs. Thatcher. So I had to go back, you know, to her life as a grocer's daughter and this woman who had a terrible Midlands accent and a voice which was very high and she was very unpleasant to listen to. And by all the stages, you know, by which she was advised, "Oh, Mrs. Thatcher, I think you should have elocution lessons." And so she got a posh accent. And then they said, "Oh, Mrs. Thatcher, if you would lower your voice, it would be easier for people to hear all these very good ideas that you have. So she did that. And then they suggested that she had her teeth capped for appearance sake, and so now she had to push this lower voice through rather larger teeth. And so by these steps, you then come to Mrs. Margaret Thatcher and how and why she sounded like she did. So
fascinating.
So there again, you know, I found out what she had been through in order to get to that.
Your work is like such a great recommendation for people to, you know, be involved in the arts, children to be taught, you know, theater and stage arts and different, because just by you know, that empathy you have for character, I think
this is our problem, that that people do cannot imagine what it feels like to be somebody else, you know, so that they cannot, so they become enemies of each other. And hate each other and look across the gulf, you know. But if, for children, you know, if drama is taught in schools so that that childlike gift of being able to imagine things, put yourself into another situation, I think it's really valuable, so that they would, you know, even among their friends, think about, what does it feel like to be so-and-so, you know? Somebody maybe that you really admire. What makes them like that? How can you feel like that yourself? Or somebody that they can't stand, you know, all the prejudice. It's a way of getting rid of the prejudice.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's really needed. I mean, especially with, you know, the lack of funding for the arts in the last couple of decades.
Oh, it's terrible. By taking away, you know, our imagination. This is the problem, that it's all designed to stop people thinking and feeling so that they can be manipulated more easily.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very sad and shocking, really. It's damaging, terribly damaging to, you know, a society's life. But it is done for quite mercenary reasons.
Yeah.
To make us do good consumers.
Right, yeah. With no personality or our own thoughts.
Yes, yes, so that we can be pushed around and we'll believe anything. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really tricky these days. This was so much, you know, we're so assaulted by so much media.
Yes.
You know, and you have no idea what's real and what's not. It's
yes, I don't think we've ever been at a time where establishing a false reality has been so such a determined policy. I mean, there are absolutely two realities. You know, the Fox News reality and the real reality. So, you know, people who come to believe what they are told, which is not true, this is terribly dangerous. I mean, it's... anyway, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, it's funny because I just read a Howard Zinn quote about, you know, all these terrible things, you know, the Holocaust and everything happened from obedience, not from disobedience. And so,
you know,
we have to question,
which
is what artists do. Artists question everything.
Yes, yes.
So, let's talk about your CD to get back to.
Well, it was about 10 years ago, I think, that I started going on the convention circuit, you know, because of the Tomb of Ligeia, because
Right, Schiller and Monster Mania,
yes, all the different ones, and also I was in Damien Omen 2 and got my eyes pecked out, so that was something to talk about. And I was amazed at how ardent the fans are for these movies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they just love Vincent Price. Well, what's not to love? I mean, I loved
Vincent
Price.
Right,
yeah. He's a brilliant actor. And I think that's been underestimated because in later times he's kind of, you know, spoofed or sent up his horror persona, you know. But he started as a Broadway actor, and his daughter, Victoria, in her book, talks about how he regarded these Gothic stories like Shakespeare, which is very true because, you know, it's very emotional situations with very high stakes expressed in heightened language. And so because of my Shakespeare background also, you know, we were, both of us felt very at home in that heightened atmosphere. It didn't feel unnatural at all. And, I mean, he's just, that voice, I mean.
And then for
as a matter of fact, because it's a love story, apparently Robert Town had said to Roger Corman, Vincent Price. I mean, he's 53. He's too old. We should get somebody else. Richard Chamberlain. Well, that was...
No. Oh, my God. Vincent Price is so good in that.
And so, I mean, Vincent, very handsome man.
Very handsome.
And, I mean, my character, the Lady Rowena, had no problem falling in love with Verdon Fell. So that was, an interesting thing that I found out later. I mean, you couldn't imagine anybody but Vincent Price in that role. And I have been
so
very
cool.
Touched by how the fans love the films and love us, you know. So I started going on the circuit in 2008, and there are a couple of conventions coming up. The 15th to the 16th of November in Boston, there's the New England Super Mega Festival. And there may be others, which Matt, you know, can let you know if they're coming up.
Yeah, please.
But we had decided that we would, we'd been talking for some time about me recording the whole story, the whole of the Ligeia story. I have at these conventions, it's quite long, so I have on certain occasions done a shortened version reading at the convention of the original story. But we decided that, let's hear the whole thing. So it's about, I think the story itself is about 40, 45 minutes. And then I added a few of the Poe poems. So,
nice.
So we're very excited to see, you know, how people enjoy that. It's intricate writing. I mean, Poe's language and his it's wonderful to experience writing that is unashamedly literary, but in such a human way. You know, one reason why I teach Shakespeare is that I am very nervous, very frightened, really, at the fact that we're losing vocabulary. Language is now being demoted, you know. I mean, we're suspicious that language means you're spinning lies rather than persuading truths. And my students are all speaking in code with their thumbs. You know, they're
right.
Not used to having so many words in their mouth. So it's really important that the beauty and the use of language is maintained, because if you don't have the words to put your ideas into words, if you don't have the words, you then stop having the ideas. You can't articulate them. So you can't think clearly and constructively and imaginatively. So I'm all for honoring big language and making it sound natural, you know. If you can open your mind to carry all those thoughts in their complexity, then it's exciting.
Well, I know it's Shakespeare. Reading Shakespeare was difficult for me, but seeing it performed was, you know, just amazing, because then you understood the language, you know.
Yes, and I mean, the way it is, I think that the if a teacher can, and the words are supposed to be spoken aloud anyway. I know at my girls' boarding school all those years ago, we acted out Shakespeare in the classroom, so that immediately it became alive, you know, and if there were words you didn't understand, you'd find out what it meant, and once you knew what it meant, then you can see it, speak it naturally. And Shakespeare, I mean, he intended that it's real people in real situations. So you know, when as an actor, when you're preparing Shakespeare, it is supposed to sound natural, heightened, yes, but real. Yes.
And you know, some of it's quite funny and interesting.
Oh yes.
Wordplay.
Oh, and bawdy too. Really, quite rude often. Yes, you know. I mean, if you think, oh, did he mean that? It's probably, oh, yes, he did.
So where can people find your CD? You're going to have it at the cons, I assume.
We will certainly have it. It's being printed at the moment, you know. It's being, and so we'll have it at the conventions. I'm sure that Matt will have ways in which people can acquire it through the Facebook page.
Okay. I'll add the link to the show notes so people can find it.
And on the, as you could see on the cover, when I was performing at the theater in Baltimore, I went on an Edgar Allan Poe pilgrimage to all, you know. So the picture of me by the statue, and then in his grave. By his grave, and I visited the house, of course, and there's a place in the Bronx. There's
right,
a Poe
right. He had a house
that we're
in
touch with. Yeah. So if there are any more public appearances, you know, for the Poe things, I'm sure that you know, Matt will let you know, and we could talk further.
Yeah, I would love to do that. Or, you know, come and shoot one of your Poe pilgrimage visits.
Yeah.
That would be really interesting.
That would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And
well, thank
yes,
you.
It was very inspiring talking to you. You made me really feel
well, I've enjoyed
wonderful.
It. You're
thank
great
you.
To talk to. So we're obviously
right.
a good match.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
We will.
Okay.
So
have a good day. Bye.
Yes, and you. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Gurr in Fangirl. If you enjoyed our show, be sure to visit our website, www.squeeprojects.com, where you can subscribe to the podcast and our YouTube channel for lots more squee as fuck pop culture content.